This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a nonprofit with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Change menus, change lives. Learn more at chefscollaborative.org.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported nonprofit food radio station. That means that every single thing we do, from broadcasting 35 weekly shows for free, to bringing you exclusive content from sold-out food events across the country, to offering scholarships to high school students, is only possible thanks to the support of our loyal members. And we want you to join the club. Become a member during our 2017 summer drive to get access to sweet swag and pledge your support to the world's only food radio station. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member now.
Good morning and welcome to The Line here on Heritage Radio. Today on the show, I welcome Dave Missoni, who has an extensive restaurant resume stretching all the way back to his childhood in Maryland. Over more than a 20-year career, Dave has worked everywhere from huge nightclubs to some of the finest Italian restaurants in the nation right here in New York City. His Three Kings restaurant group now operates several spots, including the much-beloved Tall Day in Brooklyn. They have restaurants in New York, New Jersey, Miami. They have many things opening and I assume big plans down the road. Dave, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Eli. I'm really psyched to be here.
So let's start off with the Imperial Hotel in Maryland. Tell me about how that came to be.
Sure. So I grew up in Chevy Chase, Maryland, right outside of D.C. until I was about 14. And then we moved to the Eastern Shore. My parents wanted to get us out of the city. An easier, simpler way of life. And they were like a lot of people that saw opening and owning a restaurant as a very romantic thing that they could do in their spare time, in addition to their regular careers. My dad had a big career in consulting in Washington, D.C. My mom had just closed a 20-year business as an employment agent in D.C. also. And they bought this little 13-room hotel and restaurant that was very, very, very Victorian. Like, so many Victorian, like, patterns and paisleys and prints throughout the whole place. And it had been pretty well renovated. And the hotel side wasn't really exciting to my parents. It was kind of like the structure that held this really – what they hoped was going to be a really cool restaurant. And for 10 years it was, and they owned and operated it. And I don't think they ever made a single dime. But it was a big, you know, love affair with serving great food, great wine. We had amazing chefs and,
so did you move to the hotel or you lived nearby?
No, we lived nearby about 3 blocks away in this little historic town on the Eastern Shore of Maryland called Chestertown, right on the Chester River. The hotel had been built in 1903. So it was this old historic property. It had 2 dining rooms, 1 kitchen, a tiny, tiny little library lounge. My parents didn't really know neither of them had ever done a day of work in the restaurant business.
I assume they put you to work though, right?
They put
are you guys cleaning rooms?
Oh, yeah. We did everything.
Bussing tables and.
My brother, my sister, and I'm the middle child. We did everything. I definitely seemed to be the one that was most in love with it. And I definitely, took the bait, hook, line, and sinker on loving the industry, not knowing it was going to be the rest of my life that I would be in it. But at the time, loving every minute of it.
It's interesting that they chose to do maybe the 2 most difficult businesses at the same time, which are running a hotel and running a restaurant. Yep. Both of those are prone to failure. Yep. And it's just constantly, constantly having to pay attention to detail with hospitality. So how 10 years is a really good run.
Yeah.
How did they at first, though? How do they set themselves up to even try to do that? Did they hire a chef?
Yes.
Did they hire a manager? Like, how
so
did it
they
work?
Brought an amazing chef from D.C. To the Eastern Shore. He and his wife were – the wife was front of house. The husband was the chef, and they basically ran the place for the first 3 years. A guy named Dan Turgeon, who went on to be one of the top professors at Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park. Any chef that's gone through CIA in, let's say, the late 90s to early 2000s, he was the chef teacher at American Bounty. So you couldn't graduate without Dan Turgeon giving you the final stamp of approval. And he was amazing. He had worked for Madeline Kamen, Jeffrey Boobin in D.C. What my parents focused on was what they were passionate about. They were passionate about food. They were passionate about wine. They started a wine society in the restaurant. We had monthly winemaker dinners. And they did a lot of really great work. The next chef after Dan Turgeon was a guy named Rodney Scruggs, who's went on to become the executive chef of the Occidental, one of the oldest restaurants in America, in Washington, D.C., right across the street from the White House. So we had really talented people that worked there. And a lot of the young men and women who worked under these people went on to do great things in the restaurant business. A lot of them went on to have really, really, you know, successful careers. So
you got to literally rub shoulders with people that were doing this already as their lifelong passion and careers as a young teenager. Yep. And you're kind of coming up and seeing all this happen. What did it feel like when you, when they closed the hotel? Like, what's that moment like for you? It's obviously a big part of your childhood. Sure. and your life, and you have all these probably memories of playing and working there.
Sure.
What does that feel like, and what are the takeaways from being open for 10 years and then closing down?
So right towards the end of that 10-year time span, they leased it out to another couple with the option that they were going to buy it at the end of it. The couple never made good on it, but they found someone else to buy it. But during that year, I really didn't want to work there under someone else. So I went off and did, and I guess it was a paid stage, but I went and worked at a place called the Inn at Perry Cabin, also on the Eastern Shore. At the time, it was owned by Lord and Lady Ashley. I usually, for like pop culture references, tell people it's the wedding scene in the beginning of Wedding Crashers, where Will Ferrell and Owen Wilson go for the big wedding at this big estate, and that's where it was. But it was all British butler style service. I mean, okay. It was all Brits that worked there.
Uh-huh.
I learned, I'll never forget when my wife and I first started watching Downton Abbey. I was like, I used to have to do that, like ironing the tablecloths.
Like rulers, super, super formal,
super, super, super formal. And that was my first taste at that. At the end of that year, that couple never made good on the option to buy the Imperial Hotel from my parents, and they put it on the market and found someone else. But it was during that last 6 months when they were trying to find the new people to buy it, my mom and I had to do everything. Like, everybody had quit. Nobody liked the people that had had it for the 1 year. So when it sold, it was a giant relief for me, for my parents. So there wasn't a whole lot of emotion spent on mourning the loss of it and mourning it no longer being in our family. I was happy to have it no longer being an albatross around my parents' neck.
So I read that you were the class president of your high school.
I was.
And that you had a scholarship to go to Loyola, but then you didn't end up going. So I'm curious, as sort of having that sort of resume that would lead you into college, what led you to make the decisions to not go to school, and then you came to New York City? So what was the reasons for that?
So I think in a lot of hindsight, it was that the restaurant bug had gotten into me. I just didn't know it. Mm-hmm. And there's also, the drug culture had gotten into me too, experimenting, wanting to do anything but school.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't blame that on the restaurant industry. I kind of thank the restaurant industry for it. It made me want to experiment, made me want to go try different things, made me want to get out of my little town. But it didn't make me want to go to college. And it was one of those things where my parents still are upset about it. We were 2 weeks away from freshman orientation, and I said, I'm not going.
You pulled the rug out from under them.
And so my parents said, okay, you at least need to go to community college. And if after a year of community college, you don't like it, do whatever you want to do, but you have to dry that. And my buddy and I, who also was going through a tough time, would go, because we weren't living in dorms, we would leave our parents' homes at 18, 19, drive to community college and bear left instead and go to the movies all day long and watch movies. But I was still working in restaurants. You know, right as my parents were getting ready to finally sell the hotel for real, I decided, you know, it was kind of cheesy. I was watching an episode of Inside the Actor Studio, and I was like, I should move to New York and become an actor. I think I'd done maybe two high school plays at the time.
You were ready, though.
But
you
I was so ready. It was my calling.
Broadway
was calling. And I got to New York, and I had all these actor friends who told me, you're going to pick up a you know, this was before smartphones. This was 1997. So it was like, pick up a copy of the Back Page to find out where the auditions are, who you're going to get your headshot done by. And I was doing all this in Soho because it was kind of the only neighborhood I knew at the time. And I knew I needed a job. And I landed a job at a place called Zoe on Prince Street. It's not there anymore, but it had like a good 20-year run. And the people hired me as the Lafredos, or the couple that owned it, they hired me as a junior assistant manager in training. Which, for those of you,
great title. Great title. What does it mean?
It means a most. And what a most is a male host or male hostess. And I guess I'm being a little gender specific here. But I was basically a host and a coat check and a catch all and a gopher and do whatever. And I would sit at, they were paying me nothing. And I would sit at family meal and eat like three portions because it was the only food I was getting for the day. Uh-huh. And all these young waiters were like, dude, you've got a ton of restaurant experience. Why are you doing this job? And I was like, because it's my track towards management. And it's the only way I'm going to get a manager job. And they said, no, man, just go get a waiter job for your first year.
You'll make some money.
You'll make some money. You'll be a whole lot happier.
Yeah.
And so I was only there at Zoe for about 3 months, and I walked down. They said, just start walking around the neighborhood and find some other place that you want to work. And where the Dutch is now in Soho, Andrew Carmelini's restaurant, was a restaurant called the Cub Room. And Chef Henry Mir.
Okay.
And the Cub Room was white hot when I was working there.
And I love that, you know, you just walk around the neighborhood. Like, young 20-year-olds now are like, what do you mean you just walk around? It's like, no, you're on Craigslist. That's the only way you find jobs now. But back then, you would walk in and say, are you hiring?
Yeah.
Right? And so...
This was even before Kinko's. So you'd have to find a copy store. You'd have to have printed out your resume somewhere, made copies of your resume, and walk around with this folder full of hopefully you were going to get a job with the 20 resumes you had in your folder.
Now, do people even ask for resumes? They're like, look, can you start working tonight? We lost three servers and two cooks. Like, whatever you can do, just like put on some Chef Whites and get in the kitchen.
It's
you know?
A very desperate scene in the...
So what do you learn? Like, you're working at this red hot restaurant. It's popular. It's busy. What are you... You're a young guy. Like... It must be exciting to be working at that type of restaurant. What did you learn from that experience?
So everything was exciting. New York was exciting. Working in Soho was exciting. Soho was still a gallery neighborhood. You know, there were gallery openings every night. It wasn't just an outdoor shopping mall like it is today, you know. And, you know, I'd be walking to the train and bumping into Spike Lee. I'd be seeing famous actors in the restaurant every night. And I don't think I was in that restaurant Cub Room maybe a month or two that I called my parents and I was like, I'm going to be in the restaurant business. It's what I'm going to do with my life. And they both kind of laughed and they were like, well, we always thought you would, you know.
It's their fault.
Yeah, it's their fault. Exactly.
They can't blame you. They had you bussing tables when you were a young kid.
And it was one of those things where I just started asking myself, even at, you know, whatever, I was 22, what do you think you need to be happy? And it was... Do some cool traveling, at least one trip a year, have a nice apartment and be able to pay my bills and go out and have fun. And I was like, I can get that from the restaurant industry. And I'll get that just from my own hard work, not from luck or a connection. I could get it just by working hard. And so I just put my nose to the grindstone and started working really hard for Henry. And I think within 3 or 4 months, I was because they realized I had a lot of wine knowledge. That I was like the assistant sommelier, and then From there, an assistant manager quit, and I was promoted to an assistant manager at, and everybody called me the kid. And, you know, I was 22, 23, and I was one of the managers running this really hot restaurant. And yeah, I stuck with Henry for about 3 years, not just at Cub Room. He opened a new place in Tribeca called City Hall, and I went there to be the service director.
So you're gaining all this knowledge and all this experience, and then I'm curious how you went from being in sort of a more traditional restaurant setting to, there was a club in the meatpacking district called, was it called Lotus?
It's called Lotus.
Lotus. I can imagine what the meatpacking club was like in the 90s, but can you tell us like how crazy that scene must have been? Like, that must have been wild.
I had no intentions of getting into the club world. Like I'd said, a lot of young, cool guys and girls worked for my parents and went on to do cool things. And one of my friends, a guy named Chip Connard, had done his externship from CIA at Mercer Kitchen when Mercer Kitchen had just opened. And he worked for a chef there named Richard Fernab under Jean-Georges. And he called me. He was like, hey, I'm done with my externship. And this guy, Richard, who I did my extern with, is going to be the chef of a nightclub in the meatpacking district. And there was some, I had 3.5 years with Henry was long enough. And it was time for me to move on. And I met with this guy, this chef, Richard, and he hired me in as, I wasn't running the nightclub, I was running the restaurant inside of the nightclub. I think my title was restaurant manager, but essentially I was the GM of the restaurant. So it was a huge step for me.
Did people order food in said nightclub?
So here's the thing that ended up
happening. How does that work?
It was a ton of celebrity clientele, a ton of nightlife people coming in for food. Pre the club. As time went on, it was, as is this case with all of nightlife in New York City, it was your Wall Street guys, your hedge fund guys, your stockbrokers using their dinner reservation to get access to the club because they couldn't get past the velvet rope. But they knew that if they booked a dinner reservation, and our menu was like a, at the time was like a very expensive $65 pre-fee. But you know, for people that didn't know Lotus in that time period, Lotus was the closest thing to Studio 54 since Studio 54. Like, other things maybe have surpassed it since then, but it was the hottest club in the world. And I'll never forget one of the MTV Music Awards when it was always in New York before it had gone back and forth. Mm-hmm. Little Kim was the last person speaking on live TV. And she said, hey, everybody, party's at Lotus. And 14th Street had to be shut down. And the owners of Lotus,
5,000 people showed up to go to Lotus.
It was a madhouse. And I'll never forget, I was helping the doorman. I've always been a big guy. So, you know, I've always been like kind of the de facto security when they needed an extra person. So I was helping out at the door during this mayhem that was going on. And the police had shut the door down. They were like, no one else gets in or out. And as that happened, Kid Rock and Pamela Anderson, because they were dating at the time, walked up. And I was like, sorry, I can't let you guys in. And the cops were like, are you out of your mind? Let them in or we're going to have a riot out here. So the cops made an exception for Kid Rock and Pamela Anderson.
So, you know, you're at this club and I want to know, like, obviously there's fun, there's excitement, like it's a crazy time, but what do you actually take away from that experience that's helped you now by being in like a high volume place where it's kind of scene-y? I mean, I know you do stuff in Miami and you have some hotel stuff, and I feel like, correct me if I'm wrong, Lotus is maybe closer to a hotel rooftop project than Toldé in Brooklyn is.
I didn't think I'd ever get back into that world ever again. It's not that I hated it. It was kind of like, okay, that's a notch on my resume. Glad I had that experience. I wonder if it'll ever come back to help me later in my career. And it is now. Being in the Miami scene, that Lotus experience has helped. And now owning two of the hottest rooftop bars in New York City is helping as well. I'm seeing a lot of those old familiar faces with a lot more wrinkles now, but still partying like they're...
But you know how to control a door. You know how to work a line. Like all these things that restaurant doesn't necessarily always transfer to bar. Like they're totally different animals. And
but there are so many things that we do across the industry that are the same. And
like what?
like, for example, when I was working in hotels, and I haven't done it since then, but like when I'd gone to the Inn at Perry Cabin to work there, I learned how to truly deep clean a room and how to wipe the walls down with a very, very, very low amount of soap in diluted water. And we deep clean our restaurants the same way I learned how to deep clean a guest room, you know. I don't know. That's just one example. But and then, you know, as far as the nightclub business goes and how you transitioned this nightclub from a restaurant to a nightclub and how you got people out of their seats to make way for the people coming in and buying bottles. Like it was awful. It was awful, awful, awful. But I guarantee you I can deal with any problem customer now because of it.
Before we get into sort of present day, I want to touch on you joining up with Joe and Mario, two huge names in New York at that time, and now I would say pretty much worldwide recognition. So you were at, you worked at a lot of places with them, but touch just briefly, if you can, about working as the service director at Babbo, and then any other sort of highlights with that experience. I know you were with them for several years. You must have been able to glean a lot of important things from that.
Well, so a couple things. I think one of the important things that you mentioned also was me working as a service director. And this is something that I kind of try to preach to young managers all the time. I was a service director in New York City for almost 15 years before making the jump to being a general manager. And maybe that's because no one was willing to give me a chance, but it was also because it was the road that I wanted to be on. I knew there was a ton of stuff that I could learn from people that were way better at managing restaurants than I was by continuing to be a service director. It also gave me a lot of flexibility to move around from job to job and get more experience. I was lucky enough with Joe and Mario that I got to move around within a company. So it didn't look like I was constantly jumping ship. They moved me around from restaurant to restaurant.
Can you actually just dig in a little bit? Service director versus GM. What are the main differences there? Just for people listening that are thinking that those are kind of the exact same role. They're not.
Sure, they're not. So general manager, every single solitary aspect of the restaurant is your responsibility. From the kitchen staff to the executive chef to who's doing the bookkeeping to all of the admin work that goes into running a successful restaurant. Service director, you're very myopic. You are focused on guest satisfaction and nothing but guest satisfaction and training staff and molding staff and trying to make service better and better every day. And that is your one focus. And I liked having that one focus. I then came out of that time and realized, finally making the jump to GM is going to be so easy. And it wasn't. There were so many things that staying in that one focus for a long time left some things that, you know, I hadn't learned. And my first GM job was a place called Enoteca down on the Lower East Side. And I was there for about three and a half years as the GM.
What do you think is the main thing that you took away from working with under Joe on the service side of things?
Sure.
Since he's so experienced in that realm.
I went all in with Joe and Mario. Like I drank their Kool-Aid willingly, happily, and I still tell people it was the best time of my life of working for other people. I learned more from them than anybody else. But I really went all in, almost to the point of like your brown nosing student. Like I did everything that I was asked of, that was asked of me. I had 2 days off a week from my job pretty much the entire time I was working for them, from Esca to Oto to Babbo. And one day a week, I would always commit to being Joe's assistant. And I would meet with him wherever he was during the day and get to follow him around. And I learned a lot from him. You know, I got to go into meetings with him. I got to see him planning Del Posto. I got to see his brain working on his and Mario's company development and how they were growing. You know, they went from, you know, a couple of great West Village, you know, Greenwich Village restaurants to exploding on the national and now global level. I wasn't there for that part of it, but I got to see it start.
That's an amazing takeaway that people listening can think about, which is that you sort of offered yourself up above and beyond, and in return, he gave you access, which I'm sure has shaped some of your ideas about Three Kings. We're going to take a quick break. I'm here with Dave Missoni, and when we come back, we're going to talk about you leaving a restaurant empire and going off to start your own with John and Dale. We'll be right back. Stick with us here on Heritage Radio.
This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a national nonprofit network with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Chefs Collaborative members work to make sustainable practices second nature for every chef in the United States. Chefs Collaborative was founded in 1993 by visionary chefs including Rick Bayless and Alice Waters, who acknowledge the influential role of food professionals on our food choices, our collective personal health, the vitality of cultures, and the integrity of the global environment. Chefs Collaborative believes that the greater culinary community can be a catalyst for positive change by expanding the market for good food and helping to preserve local farming and fishing communities. Change menus, change lives. Learn more about Chefs Collaborative at chefscollaborative.org.
Hi, I'm Jacqueline Orfozo.
And I'm Ben Rosenblatt.
And we are Love Bites on Heritage Radio Network.
Our show is all about why and how we love.
Tune in every Monday at 4 as we talk about endings, new beginnings in relationships, about couples who work together and love together.
And what life teaches us about love.
So support our show and all of Heritage Radio Network's programming. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on that beating heart to become a member today, and we will love you forever for it.
See ya.
Welcome back to The Line. Just a quick note on supporting Heritage Radio Network. It would be great if you're listening, if you would become a member. Heritage Radio is the world's pioneer food radio station. We broadcast live from a recycled shipping container inside of Roberta's restaurant in the back in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And as a 501c3 nonprofit, Heritage Radio runs on the support of our members and donors, and your contribution is tax deductible. Our network is united in the idea that a small group of dedicated people can change the world one soundbite at a time. So if you can, head over to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the heart, and please donate today. I'm back with Dave Massoni, and I want to jump into sort of present day where you're at right now. You've spent 15, 20 years working for other people all around New York, and you decide, all right, it's time to do my own thing. Who's John Bush? How does he figure into this story?
So John Bush was my first real New York friend. John is from the West Coast, from Santa Cruz, California. And my godbrother, who for the Gentiles out there, my mom is his godmother, and my mom and dad are his godparents. And I am his mom is my godmother. There's a great guy named Max Huber who was big in the punk rock music scene in Southern California, was the guitarist of a band called the Swinging Udders. And John Bush used to do merch with them when they'd go on tour. And John's always been a bartender, and he decided to move to New York City, I guess, about 2 years before I did. And I was home for Thanksgiving that first year that I'd moved to New York. And Max said, "Had you made any friends yet?" And he, you know, and I said, "Just the people I work with." He said, "Do yourself a favor and go to the corner of Avenue A and 7th Street to a bar named Niagara."
Which is still there. Because I used to go there.
And it's still a great bar. But really, at the time, I mean, it was the king of rock and roll bars. Like, before the LES was and the East Village had really gotten to the crazy parts that it's gotten to. But I walked in and introduced myself to John Bush, and he's been a lifelong friend ever since. And I've partied with the guy. We've complained about our bosses to each other. We've worked together. He decided he was going to start getting serious about being a bartender, more serious than just slinging drinks in a rock and roll bar, and came and was one of the opening bartenders of Oto under Mario Batali and Joe Bastianich, because he wanted to learn more about wine. And I said, "Well, hey, come bartend at this place. You'll learn tons about wine." And then he's also done, you know, worked at other cocktail bars when the whole cocktail culture started getting a little crazy, and was always trying to expand himself. And we started talking really seriously I'd say around 2009, about wanting to open our own place. We didn't know where it was going to be. We didn't know what it was going to be like. But I was working at Enoteca on the Lower East Side. Jason Denton, who was the owner of Enoteca, who's a longtime also Joe and Mario manager and partner, and was the founder of Lupa. He had been asking me, look, if you're going to open your own place someday, work at a place that's like what you want to open. And so he was like, I explained to him the type of place I wanted to open, a real casual neighborhood joint. I was tired of working in fussy restaurants. I really, really wanted to be in a casual neighborhood corner space where everybody's welcome, where you come for multiple meals during the week. The cuisine didn't really matter, but I'd been working in Italian for so long. He was like, well, why don't you come be the general manager of Enoteca? And so I was there for about 3.5 years. And during that time, John and I started planning out what this restaurant that we were going to do was going to be. I lived in Park Slope and kept walking by this corner. And the corner was at the corner of 7th Avenue and 15th Street in South Slope. And I walked in one day and asked them if they were willing to sell. I was like, I'm sorry. I know this is really forward of me, but you guys don't seem to be doing a lot of business. Curious if you'd ever think about selling your business. And they were. And so I called John and he came and looked at the space. And it was just one of those, you couldn't not look at it and say, that's a perfect pub. That's a perfect corner tavern. That's a perfect neighborhood watering joint. And so we turned it into Thistle Hill Tavern.
So did you buy the lease from someone or how did you take over the space?
We actually bought the condo, and that's also how, unfortunately, we lost the restaurant too. It was a commercial condo unit. So the whole building was condo residential, and this was a commercial condo unit as part of the condo. And so we were able to buy it from the previous owner. And so we got a mortgage and, from the punk rock music world, Fat Mike of NoFX has been one of John Bush's longtime like childhood friends. We called Mike up and said, hey, Mike, would you ever consider being our partner on this? The only way we can make it work is to buy the property. And we don't have that kind of cash. And he said, OK, I'll do it. I'll front the money for you guys to buy this piece of real estate. But the one thing he said was, I need to have a no vote clause to sell if I ever need to sell the real estate, not the business, but the real estate. And last year he called us on that no clause vote. So he was going through a divorce and needed to kind of liquidate all of his assets. And Thistle Hill, unfortunately, ended up being one of them.
So that's a tough moment for you because that's the first project that you and John do together. You've had tremendous success, a lot of growth, but did that meet that must have had a special piece your heart.
It was crushing. Yeah.
And so
John and I did everything for it. We built the place with our bare hands. When we were looking to have somebody come and do tile work for the bathrooms and we couldn't afford him, it was, let's go down to Home Depot and see if they've got a book on how to do tile, you know?
And so like that's, you both had been cutting your teeth working for other people, but that moment when you finally decide to go out on your own and do it and really do it for yourself, what's that moment feel like when you unlock the doors for Thistle Hill the first time and you both are like, holy shit, we're standing in our own restaurant? It'd probably been the first time in 15 years that you'd been your own boss, right?
Yeah. And it was the only time I'd ever been my own boss because I worked for my parents and they treated me like the worst employee that they had. So in a good way. It was huge. It was a dream come true. It was incredibly exciting and terrifying. You know, I know you've opened your own business too. And the biggest piece of advice I'd give anybody is whatever you need to live on, you better have that money for a year saved up in the bank if you're going to go try to open your own restaurant. There were terrifying moments in the first year, but you get through it.
It's the time commitment from going to being a GM or a service director at a very high intensity restaurant doesn't quite compare to being the person who has to like fix the sink when it breaks whatever.
And luckily, my wife and I and our 1 year old son lived a block from Thistle Hill, two blocks from Thistle Hill Tavern. So that was huge. And to this day, my son, who's almost 9, and my daughter, who's 5, my wife and I can be anywhere in the world. And people, older folks, will come up to us and be like, you have the most well-behaved kids in a restaurant I've ever seen. It's because they grew up in the restaurants. Right. And I was not going to be the owner of the restaurant who had a kid who couldn't behave in a restaurant. So
awesome. Yeah. So how do you meet Dale and become – how do you go from two to three kings?
So we met Dale before we even opened Thistle Hill. I was the GM at Enoteca, and there was a Saturday night. And for those of you that know New York City, or any city that's cold during the winter, the first couple days of spring when the weather breaks, New Yorkers lose their effing minds.
Yeah.
I always say, you know, sorry to gross anybody out, but be prepared to mop up some vomit tonight because someone's going to get too drunk.
Yeah, people love to really crack into it the first couple days, for sure.
And one of those first days at Enoteca, it was beautiful. The wait for an outside table was 2 hours. And Dale had just finished doing Top Chef season 4. And I instantly recognized him. And the hostess told him it was going to be a 2-hour wait. And he was like, all right, well, put our name down and we'll walk around the neighborhood and we'll come back. And I ran up to the hostess as he was walking away. And I said, did you see which way he went? And Enoteca was right next door to Babes in Toyland. Which is the sex shop right next door. And so I walked in, and he and his girlfriend at the time were in there, and he had a big, giant black dildo in his hand. And I said, hey, Mr. Talda, your table's ready. And I said, if you have time to put that dildo down, your table's ready. And he started laughing and came in, and we were friends from there on out. And we'd go for drinks, and we'd hang out. And while John and I were building Thistle Hill Tavern, he called me one day, and he was like, hey, can I come out and see how it's going? I said, sure. Came out. He checked out construction. It was the first time he'd ever been out to Brooklyn. And then we invited him back for opening night. He was there for opening night with his girlfriend. And then the next night, the second night, he was back again. And he was having drinks. And we were friends. But I was like, yo, bro, you're back again tonight? He was like, yeah. Just wanted to come and see how it was going. And he was the last person there. And it was just John, Dale, and I at the bar. And we'd all gotten pretty drunk. And he was like, hey, guys, I'm not supposed to tell anybody this, but I've been asked back for another season of Top Chef, and it's going to be season 8, and it's going to be an all-star season. I don't care if I'm the first one voted off or I win the whole damn thing. I'm opening my own restaurant when it's over and done with. I didn't do it after season 4 because I had a lot more to learn, but I'm ready now. And everything I see that you guys are doing with Thistle Hill is what I want to do, but with an Asian restaurant. I want it to be a neighborhood joint. I want it to be. And we thought he was just about to ask us for advice. And he was like, would you guys consider being my business partners? And that's where it started.
So Talde opens in 2012, Jersey City 2014, Miami 2015. I want to know, like, what do you think the contributing factors were to make Talde go from, quote unquote, a neighborhood modern Asian restaurant to a 3-unit restaurant in a very short period of time?
I think a big part of it is luck and being in the wake of people like David Chang. Dale never worked for David, neither did I. I mean, we only know him very, very casually in passing at a food event. But we were very lucky that what he was doing and what other chefs like him and guys like Danny Bowen and was really, really changing the way the world was looking at Asian food. And that Asian food didn't need to be gimmicky, and it could be as normal of a corner place doing really cutting edge Asian food as a bistro, as a pizzeria, as as any other restaurant. And so we were really lucky that that all happened at the same time, and that we were kind of in that wake, and we kind of got on board. And a good guy that you and I both know in the world of PR, a gentleman by the name of Kong Fan, kind of helped us coin and be a part of the term of calling what we were doing Asian American. Everybody had heard of Italian American, Jewish American, German American when it came to food, but the term of Asian American and these young, you know, first or second generation Asian chefs cooking the food that either they grew up around or had been inspired by, but through their lens of being an American and having gone to culinary school or worked for, great European style chefs, was all kind of coming together, and we got to be a part of that. So
I've always found Talde to be an exciting restaurant, and also not only because of the food, but also because of the vibe and the clientele. Like, you can tell that there's a good blend when you eat there of neighborhood folks and mm-hmm. people that have traveled to eat there.
Thanks.
How do you manage expectation when you're in Brooklyn and you've got one location, three people, you can all kind of have eyes on the space. How do you manage expectations when you open up in Jersey City and Miami and people kind of know it as like TV star Dale Talde's restaurant? Are the expectations a lot higher in Miami to kind of, you know, blow people's socks off as opposed to someone in Brooklyn who's like, that's just the good restaurant that's down the road from my apartment and I love it, you know?
So I think people are so weird, but human nature. I think what we do food-wise from Talde Brooklyn to Talde Jersey City to Talde Miami Beach is really not different at all. There are different dishes. Each executive chef gets to put a little bit of their spin on playing with Dale's style of cuisine. They can't go completely rogue, but they get to each do their own little spin. What has really been the change from one location to the next has been design and decor and living up to those kinds of expectations. Because I think when people first come into a space, everything's about the visual, how it makes them feel. And in Talde Brooklyn, the first Talde that we opened, it's very, very neighborhoody. It's a very simple room. There's some beautiful, beautiful, beautiful old Asian wood carvings around the room. But other than that, it's, I've had people walk in and say, is this an Italian restaurant? What kind of food do you serve here? Because it's not in your face in any way whatsoever.
I guess from the front doorway and from the bar, you might not really be able to grasp what's going on. But those ornate wood carvings, you guys tracked those down, right?
Yeah.
There's like a cool story behind them,
yeah.
How you found them.
So when we were building out the space had been a laundromat when we took it over. Mm-hmm. But before that, it had been a bar many, many years ago called Radigan's. And all we wanted to do, John and I, was make the space feel like it had never been a laundromat at any point and had just been an old bar or restaurant that had been there for many years. Kind of the same thing we did at Thistle Hill Tavern. And there were going to be little Asian touches, but we didn't even know what they were. And we went there. They've got a couple stores around the city, and sometimes you see their trucks, a company called Old Good Things. And their main warehouses are out in Scranton, Pennsylvania. So we took a day trip out to Scranton, and in the first 10 minutes, we found this old fireplace mantelpiece. And we fell in love with it, and we asked if we could buy it. And they said, no, it's part of an entire room that we took out of this old mansion in Mamaroneck, New York. It was owned by a man named Arnold Constable, who kind of invented the modern-day department store, predating Macy's. It was Arnold Constable Department Stores. And his home was like up in Mamaroneck was like a little mini Hearst mansion in that every room in the house had a different theme. And his home office or study was the Oriental study. And it was all done with these wood carvings. And so I think we had maybe $40,000 set aside for decor and design. And we said, so how much is it for the whole set, for the whole room? And they were like $200,000. And we were like, and another friend who wasn't one of our partners, just a friend went with us. And he was like, guys, just walk away. You can't do it. And we couldn't get over it. And so by the end of the day, looking through the entire place, John pulled me aside and he was like, if I ever walk into someone else's restaurant or bar and they got this, I'll want to kill myself. So we pulled the owners of Old Good Things aside and we were like, can we make a deal? Can we pay you over time? And they were really, really sweet people that let us pay them over time.
That's awesome. And yeah. It really just, I mean, I know you brought in new bones to the space, but it does feel like
it belongs there. Yeah,
yeah.
It makes it feel like it was always there. And then one of the nice things is a little piece of that old wood, because there was a lot left over, made it into Talde Jersey City, and a little bit of it made it into Talde Miami Beach too.
Very cool. Yeah. So you've got sort of a current theme running through every spot.
A little thread of history.
Very nice. Before we get into some of the newer projects, I do just want to touch on Pork Slope, which was another sort of beloved neighborhood project that, you know, you do these projects that are very much like the cheer spot, mm-hmm. where everyone can kind of hang out. Mm-hmm. Can you speak, for those who have never gone, tell us a little bit about what Pork Slope was like? And also, I would love to hear about, you know, as you're having this forward upward trajectory, you have had a couple setbacks, which
sure.
is interesting to hear about, even though you have almost nine spots now. What does it feel like in the midst of success to have setbacks as well when you're closing spaces?
So I think having setbacks puts you into a club of restaurateurs that is all of them, because we've all had setbacks. But it becomes one of those things where almost like the people you look up to and the people that you've kind of been following in the restaurant industry, when you have one of these setbacks, you get a lot of like the old dad or the uncle arm around the shoulder and like, okay, so you've been through that now. You know, what did you learn from it? Mm-hmm. And so we've had some good people that we've been able to talk to over the years that have kind of helped us get through that painful thing of closing one of your babies, you know, and closing one of the things that you had a lot of hopes for. Pork Slope was a great neighborhood bar. Pork Slope really started with the name. We were in Park Slope. We had talked very, very casually about the idea of doing a barbecue joint. Because the barbecue wave that kind of hit New York hadn't happened yet. At Thistle, in its first year, we would constantly ask our regular guests, what do you think the neighborhood's missing? What do you think the neighborhood's missing? What do you think the neighborhood's missing? And luckily for us, it kept the number one was modern Asian cuisine. We so opened Talde.
Filled that void.
We filled that void. And the other one was barbecue. Places like Fleischer's hadn't opened yet. Martin's hadn't opened yet. A lot of other great places had not opened yet in New York. And we were a month away from opening. And it was barbecue, barbecue, barbecue was what we were going to do. And our PR firm at the time told us, hey, guys, we just want to give you the heads up before you see it in the press. Dinosaur Barbecue is opening their first Brooklyn location two blocks away from you. And maybe we should have just stuck to our guns and done barbecue, but we let this, and we're friends with John Stage, who owns Dinosaur. He's given us good advice over the years, too. But we panicked, and we started changing the concept. And from the day we found out Dinosaur Barbecue was coming in to the day we closed, we were constantly tinkering and tweaking and changing Pork Slope to the point where it never truly had its business identity. People loved it as a bar, but we were constantly behind the eight ball, and we were never making any money. And our bookkeeper and our accountant sat us down one day and said, yeah, you know, if you're not finding a fix to change this to a money-making establishment, we think you guys should close it and put it on the market. So,
Mile End staff party my first year in New York City was at Pork Slope.
Yeah.
We had a good time.
Yeah, it was a good party.
We drank quite a few and had a lot of really delicious sandwiches. And it's always kind of sad to see something go, but as a restaurateur, you have takeaways from it. As you moved forward with the Three Kings restaurant group, you've gotten into this, it's the hotel world. Mm-hmm. You've come full circle, and now you're back in hotels where mm-hmm. everything started. How does one get into a hotel? It's sort sure. of like the holy grail of restaurateur yeah. life, because there are a lot of benefits to being yep. in a hotel. Can you speak about how you first got involved with Confidant in Miami yep. and then also now you're in the Arlo and sure. then you're about to be in 50 Bowery. Yep. So now you're like the hotel guy all right. of a sudden.
So we were just saying this the other day. We did an event in Manhattan for City Harvest. And one of the things that restaurant people love, chefs and restaurateurs love about events is that hour before the event starts where you get to catch up with all of your friends. And we consider ourselves very lucky. And I say, you know, Eli, you and your brother Max are part of it. I think we are all part of a really fun group of restaurateurs who have come about in their careers at the same time. I love our friends that, you know, have opened restaurants at the same time we have. And at every one of these events, somebody is always pulling us aside and saying, so what's the secret? How'd you get into the hotel world? Tell me, man. We want to get in there, too. It was luck. It was all luck. I worked with a guy who had gotten into corporate food and beverage director positions. And we bumped into him at South Beach Wine and Food Festival one year. And he said, how quickly can you guys put together a pitch for a restaurant in this hotel? The hotel is now called The Confidant. At the time, it was being opened as the Thompson Hotel Miami Beach. Somebody had pulled out, and their contract was still in negotiation. And we were told, you're going to put a pitch together. You have to present it to us, do a performa, the whole nine yards. You may get it, you may not. And what impressed this company was how quickly we did it. It was based on Talde. It was Talde, Miami Beach. So we had real numbers to show them. It wasn't guesswork at all. We knew what our numbers were. We knew what our cost of goods were. And we were able to pitch very, very boldly. And I think that's what sealed the deal. And we landed that. And one has just spread to the next. We're in three hotels now, the Confidant in Miami, the Arlo Hotel in Nomad Neighborhood, where we have Missoni in the Heights. And we've just opened Hotel 50 Bowery down in Chinatown, where we'll have three venues there, the first of which is open, called The Crown. And that all happened in a short amount of time, but one breeds a lot more. We've probably turned down, and no exaggeration, 20 other hotel offers in the time that those three happened. And I think it is the lessons that we learned from Pork Slope, more than Thistle, because Thistle was just an unfortunate real estate issue. But the lessons we learned from Pork Slope of sticking to your guns, knowing what your concept is, knowing what you're trying to be as a brand, and the age-old saying, if you don't respect your brand, no one else will. You know, and that's kind of, if we keep getting these hotel deals and they're the right fits, we'll keep taking them if we're lucky enough.
Beyond the vast experience of you three combined, the multiple years that you have, and then getting one underneath your belt in Miami, has it got any easier?
Sure. Yeah.
And do you think that now there's a potential, and is there a desire to have 10 Taldes, to have, you know, 5 Missonis? Is that a direction that you want to go in, or are you thinking of keeping things more siloed and doing hotels with unique projects inside of them?
I would say anything is possible. If people keep coming to us saying, we want another Talde, we want another Missoni, are you willing to do it? Well, those are two brands we feel very strongly about. We know how they run. We know they're successful. We know we can make money. We know we can make guests happy with those two brands. So if people keep coming to us asking for that, yeah, we'll do them. But Dale and John and I often say, you know, that gets a little boring too. And we have a lot of other creative ideas in our heads. And you know, the restaurant that we're opening in Hotel 50 Bowery is going to be called Rice and Gold, and there will definitely be some Asian flair to it. But you know, we're Asian fusion. When we first opened Talde, was kind of like a corny, you know, dated term for a restaurant. What we're going to do at Rice and Gold is also kind of a corny, dated term, which is global fusion cuisine. And that's what we're going to be doing, and we're going to be proud of it. We'd love to keep doing new things. John, also in the hotel world, there's opportunities for multiple venues. Sometimes a hotel needs a great restaurant and a cocktail bar, or a great restaurant and a nightlife component. And John, having spent his entire world and his entire career behind bars, we have a lot of great concepts for just drinking holes too, you know. Mm-hmm. And whether it be, you know, a speakeasy type of feel, or a modern high-end cocktail kind of joint, or an everyman bar tucked away inside of a fancy hotel, there's a lot of other things we want to do.
Before we went on air, you mentioned that you have a buddy who's got a restaurant group, and they've gotten to a point, they're large, and they needed to bring on a CEO. I'm curious, is there a point that you see at which Three Kings grows to a level at which the three of you decide that you're now a real actual big company, and you're not a restaurant group that's just catching luck and getting, yeah, a lot of wind beneath the sails? Like, is there a point where you say to yourself, we've gotten bigger than what I think we can handle?
Yes. Short answer is yes. I think we are, if we're lucky enough, going to be able to grow to a place where John, Dale, and I don't necessarily have the skill set or the time management skills to get it all done ourselves. So I think bringing in people that have more experience in that world will be our direction. But that's a scary thing. You know, one of the things that I think a lot of entrepreneurs need to say to themselves and be bold about themselves to get to become a successful entrepreneur is to feel like you're the best at what you're doing. And to say that you have gotten to a point where to continue to grow, you need somebody better than yourself is a little bit of a chip away at your own ego. And I think you have to do that. I think you have to set your ego aside if you want to grow past your own strengths in some respects. And I think there are things that as we do that, John, Dale, and I will actually get to maybe have a little bit more fun, although we have fun every day, a little bit more fun at being the friend that you referenced that was talking about having to hire a CEO said, and I think my new title is going to be founder of his company. And there's a certain kind of fun ring to that. You know, I don't know if that will be the route for John, Dale, and I, but the three of us being the co-founders of Three Kings Restaurant Group kind of has a fun ring to it.
Dave, thanks for joining us. There's a bunch of places where you can find Dave, John, and Dale's spots all across the Eastern Seaboard. So it's probably the best way is to follow Dave on Twitter or go over to the Three Kings and check out all their spots. But of course, they've got Tolde in Brooklyn and then multiple locations opening up in Manhattan. Appreciate you joining us here on the line and sharing all your stories. And we'd love to have you back on and hear more about these new hotel projects and how they unfold. Thanks again for being here.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Everybody join us every week, Tuesdays at 11 a.m. for a new chef or restaurateur here on the line.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.